News, I'm Tommy McNeil. Europe is at a political crossroads as far-right and Green parties made big gains in parliamentary elections. Reuters correspondent Ryan Brooks takes a look.
The country was supposed to have already left the EU, but hasn't been able to decide how, when, or even if it will deliver Brexit.
Thank you.
The new Brexit party of Nigel Farage has humiliated the ruling Conservatives and main opposition Labour Party, according to projections. It looks to have won the most votes, while the pro-EU Lib Dems, Greens and Change UK were combined, still a few percentage points behind. Meanwhile, in France, President Macron's centrist movement looks to have been narrowly edged into second place by Marine Le Pen's anti-immigration, anti-Brussels national rally. A similar outcome in Italy, where the far-right League is emerging as the largest party. In Greece, the ruling leftist party suffered a heavy, unexpected defeat by the opposition Conservatives.
That's Reuters' Ryan Brooks. There was some relief in Brussels that nationalist parties didn't score as big a victory as centrists feared. There was also a surprise groundswell of support for smaller, strongly pro-EU parties. Syria says an Israeli airstrike on a Syrian anti-aircraft position near the Golan Heights Monday killed one soldier and wounded three. Israel has acknowledged firing at the Syrian position but has not given any details. Meanwhile, the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights says that Syrian missile strikes on Idlib province have killed at least 17 people, including at least five children. Idlib is the last major section of northwestern Syria still under rebel control. Idlib has become home to hundreds of thousands of surrendering rebels and their families. The United Nations has warned of a humanitarian catastrophe in Idlib if Syria and Russia launch an all-out attack on the province. This is VOA News. President Trump is breaking with tradition by criticizing another U.S. politician while on visit to foreign soil. During his visit to Japan, Mr. Trump said he agreed with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un and his assessment of former U.S. Vice President and 2020 presidential candidate Joe Biden. AP's Rita Foley has more.
President Trump and Japan's prime minister were holding a joint news conference in Tokyo when a reporter asked him why he appeared to side with North Korea's autocratic leader about Joe Biden.
I can tell you that Joe Biden was a disaster.
The president broke with a long-standing tradition of avoiding partisan squabbles while on foreign soil and let it fly.
Kim Jong-un made a statement that Joe Biden is a low IQ individual. He probably is, based on his record. I think I agree with him on that.
The president said he is not a Biden fan. I'm Rita Foley.
The United States paused Monday to honor its war dead on the annual Memorial Day holiday. With U.S. President Trump in Japan on a visit, Vice President Mike Pence laid a wreath at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldiers at Arlington National Cemetery, just outside of Washington, D.C. He told hundreds of military dignitaries and relatives of the fallen that their duty was to serve, or duty is to honor them.
We can never repay the debt of gratitude we owe to the men and women who have given all to preserve our freedom. But we can honor them, remember them, cherish their families, and this we will do, not just this day, but every day. And so long as our nation continues to produce men and women of such selfless courage and patriotism, I know that freedom will ring for ourselves and our posterity.
Parades and somber remembrances are planned in U.S. cities, large and small, to recall the ultimate sacrifice that hundreds of thousands of Americans have made for their country's freedom through its 243-year existence, along with the Memorial Day also marks the unofficial beginning of the summer in the United States. A U.S. citizen has become the 11th person to die while climbing Mount Everest in the past 10 days. Christopher Kulish, a lawyer from the mountain state of Colorado, died Monday while returning from the summit. The cause of his death is unclear. Last week, an American died while descending in what is believed to be a case of altitude sickness. Late May is rush hour for climbers attempting to summit Mount Everest because it usually provides a short window of favorable weather. The number of climbers trying to summit during that window has grown unsustainable. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News. We'll be right back.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today is Tuesday, May 28th, and here are some of the stories we're covering. Malawi President Peter Mutharika has been re-elected.
I, Justice Dr. Jane Maemu Ansah, hereby declare candidate Professor Arthur Peter Mutharika as the President-elect of Malawi.
Justice Jane Ansah is the chair of the Malawi Electoral Commission. The main opposition Malawi Congress Party says it plans to challenge the results. Nelson Chamisa has been re-elected as the leader of Zimbabwe's opposition MDC. Desperate Zimbabweans risk their lives in illegal gold mining. And Sierra Leone's Anti-Corruption Commission says it plans to appeal the acquittal of two former Football Association officials on corruption charges.
My preliminary observation of everything is that we have concerns at the way the judge addressed the issue of misappropriation of public funds. The precedent that he has established is a very dangerous one for the fight against corruption.
Francis Ben Kaifala is the head of Sierra Leone's Anti-Corruption Commission. Our African Languages series continues this morning with a focus on the Gaya language of Ghana. And planning experts seek solutions to rapid urbanization. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Malawian President Peter Mutharika has been re-elected in a close election, which ended up in court after the opposition claimed there have been incidents of vote manipulation. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
Malawi Electoral Commission Chairperson Jane Ansah announced the results Monday after the commission lifted an injunction in the High Court by opposition Malawi Congress Party Saturday, which demanded a vote recount in 10 districts.
I, Justice Dr. Jane Maemu Ansah, SC, Justice of Appeal, hereby declare candidate Professor Arthur Peter Mutharika as the President-elect of Malawi and Everton Herbert Chimulilenji as Vice President-elect of Malawi following the 21st May 2019 presidential elections.
Mutharika, who is a leader of the ruling Democratic Progressive Party, won by 38.57%, while his opponent, Lazarus Chakwera, leader of the opposition Malawi Congress Party, trailed by 35.41%. Vice President Saulos Chilima of the opposition United Transformation Movement Party came third with 20.24%. Secretary General of the Malawi Congress Party, Ezinhoa Nkaka, told reporters Saturday that the party will not accept results if Chakwera loses the polls. Commission Chairperson Ansah appealed to those who have lost to accept defeat.
For those who have not made it this time, I say that this is the decision of the majority of Malawian voters, and we must accept it with grace and generosity. And I encourage you to continue to play your part in building Malawi into a greater nation.
MCP Sinkaka told VOA on Monday that he could not comment on the results. However, officials and supporters of the ruling DPP were celebrating their victory. Joseph Elikagwa is among the DPP supporters. He says, "I'm very happy today. I know others are sad." In parliamentary elections, the ruling DPP won 62 seats, while MCP secured 55 seats. A swearing-in ceremony is set for Tuesday at Kamuzu Stadium in Blantyre. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre.
The main opposition Malawi Congress Party, the MCP, says it plans to challenge the outcome of the May 21st presidential election. Officials at the party's legal team is meeting to determine its next line of action. Maurice Muntali is a spokesman for the Malawi Congress Party.
We have already begun that kind of shattered diplomacy among the presidential candidates. We already met with the presidential candidate for Malawi Congress Party. We have sought for an audience with the president of the United Transformation Movement, UTM, and we are also seeking an audience with the current president, Professor Arthur Peter Mutharika. And we would like to meet with them and hear from their side and sharing the problems, the challenges that are there, and sharing with them again the possibilities of resolving this problem. That's what we are currently doing at Public Affairs Committee.
What about the Electoral Commission itself? Because it is the only institution mandated by the Constitution to administer elections in the country. A court injunction has been sought and approved to prevent the electoral body from announcing the presidential election. Are you engaging them as well?
Yes, we actually tried once to seek again an ordinance with the Malawi Electoral Commission. That was on the Saturday. But the initial response from there was not encouraging, because they said they had resolved all the problems from the stakeholders. But when they say that they had resolved all the problems, the court injunction was actually in place. And so we'll continue to engage with them because they are very important stakeholders. The Constitution mandates them to administer the elections, and there are a number of problems. Surely, we'll continue to ask an audience with them so that we can actually speak together.
Some Malawians are expressing concern that there could be constitutional crisis because the Electoral Commission would have at least 2 days to declare the winner of the presidential election. Where does the Public Affairs Committee go from here?
For us, it's okay to continue to seek progress with the Malawi Electoral Commission and the relevant other bodies, for example, the Chief Justice, if it need be, because if the Malawi Electoral Commission goes ahead and declare the results, the tempers right now, anything can happen, and we don't want that to happen. So that is very important at this critical time. I just wish that the Malawi Electoral Commission would appreciate the importance of dialogue at this time.
Maurice Mutale is the spokesman for the Malawi Congress Party. He spoke with viewers Peter Clotty from the commercial capital Blantyre. The leader of Zimbabwe's main opposition movement for Democratic Change Party, Nelson Chamisa, was re-elected over the weekend to another term. The guest of honor was Uganda opposition leader and popular musician Robert Chakulayi, also known as Bobby Wine. Nkululeku Sibanda, spokesman for Nelson Chamisa, says both Chamisa and Bobby Wine are the future leaders of Africa.
I think what it means is that Zimbabweans recognize that he brought a new sense of energy and encouraged a lot of young people to become participants in politics again, and gave older people the hope that things can change is certainly very true. But it also means that the struggle that Zimbabweans have started to deal with matters of importance such as the economic rot in the country, corruption and nepotism, continues and will not have to be restarted. It is also significant on the African continent because Mr. Chamisa has developed connections and friendships with various political players across the continent who are willing to turn Africa onto a new and fresh start, a new leap forward, something that's more progressive than we've seen in the last half a century.
Talking about Mr. Chamisa making connections with various political leadership across the continent, the guest of honor at your event was Bobby Wine, Robert Chakulayini from Uganda. What did that mean? Because Bobby Wine said that he believes that Zimbabwe and Uganda opposition politicians are fighting the same cause.
It is true. I mean, the bulk of Africa is fighting against an elitist that has entrenched itself and clothed itself in corruption, murder and brutality over the last half a century. Both Bobby Wine and President Chamisa believe firmly that Africa can turn the corner and Africa can in fact begin to progress much in the same way as Asia has begun to move forward, regardless of the history of colonization there as well. So we are seeing seismic shift here on the African continent, and it begins with the struggles in Zimbabwe and in Uganda.
Mr. Chamisa said that the MDC is going to push for early elections so as to solve the economic situation of the country.
President Chamisa understands very well, and he's been telling a lot of people, that Zimbabwe's problems are primarily political, and if you're going to solve the Zimbabwean economic crisis, you're going to have to look first at the political situation, and there are necessary, in fact, important reforms that need to take place there. And when those reforms have taken place, if you're going to restore legitimacy, you're going to have to look at such things as elections, the courts, all the public institutions, and the independent structures of a government. And it is clear that President Chamisa is talking about that. Given that the situation in Zimbabwe is probably the worst in the world other than in Venezuela economically, there is no fuel, there is no electricity, there are no hospitals that are open, there is no medication, and prices are rising by the hour. Inflation is over 245%. There is no doubt that even the most unreasonable person, including those in government, will begin to realize that there is an urgent and unavoidable need for reform in all areas of society, starting with political reform.
Mr. Sibanda, thank you very much for speaking with us on Daybreak Africa.
Nkululeko Sibanda, a spokesman for Zimbabwe opposition leader Nelson Chamisa. He spoke with me from the capital, Harare. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on The Voice of America. I'm James Botti in Washington. Today is Tuesday, May 28th. Daybreak Africa time, 16 minutes past the hour. Officials in Zimbabwe say the bodies of 8 illegal miners have been retrieved from an abandoned gold mine about 50 kilometers north of the capital, Harare. The news Monday was a reminder of the risk faced by desperate illegal miners trying to make a living in the economically troubled Zimbabwe. Over the weekend, Columbus Mavunga traveled to Matopo, a gold-rich area in southern Zimbabwe, and spoke with men who enter such mines despite the danger involved.
These men are illegal miners using a metal detector to search for gold at the Nugget mine about an hour's drive from Bulawayo, Zimbabwe's second largest city. Pino Ndinginyoni is one of those who entered the mine despite the recent collapse of a mine shaft that killed four men. Pino says he has no choice but to take the risk. Problems at home force me to do this. We need school fees, we need food, there are medical bills to be taken care of. So all that force you to stay in the bush, says Ndinginyoni. In this cold weather, we sleep in shacks while the wife is at home. At times, we can go for 3 months without getting anything, he says. A few minutes later, the illegal miners disappeared into the bush at the site of officials in the area. Once the coast is clear, they reappear. No man gives up is the motto of 42-year-old Edward Majgauta lives by. He says he has gold rush dreams, but he says on several occasions he has gone for months on a wild goose chase. But what about fears of being trapped under as what happened a few meters away? I do not fear death because I usually get cold before depth gets past my height. So that cannot collapse on me, says Majgauta. But those who go under have a higher risk of the shaft collapsing on them, he says. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Matopo, Zimbabwe.
The chairman of Sierra Leone's Anti-Corruption Commission says his commission plans to appeal a court ruling acquitting two former officials of the Sierra Leone Football Association from corruption charges. Football Association President Aisha Johansson and her former secretary Chris Kamara had been facing charges for misappropriation of funds, but Justice Regina Flynn Monday cleared the two of all charges. Anti-Corruption Commission Chair Francis Ben Kaifala says without any prejudice and with all due respect for the judge, the commission plans to appeal the ruling because it disagrees with the judge's interpretation of misappropriation of public funds.
While I am away in Vienna, the judgment has been sent to me, and I have reviewed it, and my preliminary observation of everything is that we have concerns at the way the judge addressed the issue of misappropriation of public funds. The precedent that he has established is a very dangerous one for the fight against corruption, particularly when it comes to what constitutes misappropriation. Because he is basically saying, if you are giving money to do a specific thing and you do something else, if what you did is not dishonest, then you will not be guilty of misappropriation. But the cases we have on the issue clearly establish otherwise. So while we have no issue with his general judgment, we believe that he did all he could in his own best ability as a judge, and we respect his decision. We believe those issues have to be looked into by a higher tribunal, and that is why we are considering appealing against that. And even the way he views some of the evidence, some evidence which we think he used, indicate the accused persons were a little bit extrinsic. So these are all things we are looking into, and we are considering appealing against it. Without any prejudice or with all due respect to the judge and his decision, we respect it. But as a commission, we believe that the law has to be looked into. And preliminarily, our position is that we are going to appeal.
Mr. Chairman, as you know, Sierra Leone lost a great deal because of this case. FIFA suspended the Sierra Leone Football Association from its ranks on the grounds of government interference. Sierra Leone's qualifying matches for the 2019 African Cup of Nations were scrapped. The Confederation of African Football Association then disqualified Sierra Leone from the qualifying campaign. The country lost a great deal. So the question is it worth it?
Well, there's a price to pay for doing the right thing sometimes. The country took a position after the change of regime that we were serious about the fight against corruption. And you know, with the benefit comes the burden. If this particular case is a burden we have to bear as a country, I think the people are mentally prepared to stand with it, because they understand that we are the Anti-Corruption Commission are doing the right thing. We are doing this in the interest of the country. Corruption is a very dangerous thing. For so long, we have been babysitting corruption in Sierra Leone. For the first time, the people can see that a real conscientious effort is being put into fighting corruption. We have won 17 straight cases. This is the first case that has been lost since I became commissioner. We have recovered nearly $2 million of stolen funds within the past 11 months. So these gains are very substantial that the country will have to weigh a balance. But at the position we are coming from at this stage is that fighting corruption is more important than anything else. And that is what we are doing. In this case, is there a testament of our resolve to fight corruption. That is why when FIFA came saying that if you don't reverse the decision, we will ban you, we said our laws are supreme, and our law says that if a person is being tried for corruption, the person has to step aside. We prefer to stand by our laws, and that is a very privileged position that we are in. I think we did that with pride and love for our country, and I'm very proud for my countrymen for standing by us when we took that decision, and we still stand by it.
Mr. Chairman, we're always very happy to speak with you, and thank you very much.
You're welcome, James.
Francis Bankai Fala is the head of Sierra Leone's Anti-Corruption Commission. He was speaking with me from Vienna, Austria. This year is the year of indigenous languages, and language activists in Africa are working to put the spotlight on threats that local languages face and what that means to people in their regions. To learn more about some of these languages, Reiki Stryak has put together a 5-part series that explores 5 different West African languages. For the 3rd installment, Shreya spoke to Na Ayu Awu, an advocate for the Ga language.
There are the varying numbers for the number of people who speak Ga. Ga is originally spoken by inhabitants of Accra, Ghana. Ethnologue lists about 700,000. Of course, that's a diaspora.
Between 600,000 and 900,000 in Accra is around the number, and then there's obviously people outside of Accra who speak it as well. But that number is kind of unknown.
Yes.
What kind of cultural and traditional ideas can kind of be transmitted or communicated through the language that maybe can't be communicated through English?
I would say that Ga language and in the tradition itself is, we have our own cosmology and our own way of understanding and seeing the world. And so, for example, I remember posting the Ga Samai, and the Ga Samai, I guess they're equivalent to what the Akan call their Dinkra symbols. And these symbols, they encapsulate a lot of traditional ways of knowledge, you know. So they encapsulate proverbs. They also encapsulate advice, advice for living, you know, advice for living wisely.
What kind of ideas, or can you think of any examples of ideas or philosophies that are communicated through Ga that, you know, would be lost if you lost the language?
Oh, okay. So one thing that I can tell you, I can, for example, point out is the Ga system of naming. So the Ga names actually are like an address, right? The moment I tell you my name, you know which family I come from, and you know where the family house is located, you know which clan I come from, you know which city or which town I come from.
But the last name and the first name, or just the last name?
Absolutely, last name and the first name. So, for example, my last name tells you which clan I come from and where that clan's family house is located, right? So, for example, if I were lost and I just said my last name, you would know where to take me.
Are there efforts from local governments and schools to use Ga in schoolwork, in coursework, in literature, in ways to, I guess, you know, encourage the speaking of the language?
Since 2010 or 11, there's been a new bilingual education policy that has been put in place by the government, and it's sponsored by the USAID in collaboration with the Ghana Education Service. So the National Literacy Accelerated Program, and this uses 11 Ghanaian languages. There are 81 languages that exist in Ghana, that are known to exist in Ghana. There are about 3 or 4 sign language varieties, but the rest are oral languages. And I believe about 76 of these languages are indigenous to Ghana. The NALAP bilingual program, which uses 11 of these indigenous languages, Ga is one of them. It's used in elementary schools from kindergarten to grade 3.
That was Na Oyu Owu, an advocate for the Ga language of Ghana. She was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Toronto. About 3,000 delegates, including 4 presidents, cabinet ministers, urban planners, and population experts, are attending the United Nations Habitat Assembly this week in Nairobi. They are seeking better urban and sustainable planning to deal with rising populations as well as the effects of climate change. Cyril Kimani reports from the Kenyan capital.
At the inaugural United Nations Habitat Assembly, delegates put their heads together, hoping to find solutions to make big cities more habitable. For Africa, urgent solutions will be needed. The United Nations estimates that nearly half of the continent's populations live in slums. The theme of the summit is innovation for a better quality life in cities and communities. UN Habitat Director for Africa, Naison Mutizwa Mangaza, says innovation will be key in transforming the continent's urban areas.
We hope there will be a lot of ideas shared on innovations on how to plan our cities, how to manage them, how to do transport in a more imaginative way. For me, it would be how to grow African economies using urbanization as a tool.
The assembly is to be held every 4 years and comes as more people are living in urban areas than rural areas, posing a challenge for urban planners, according to Kenya's president, Uhuru Kenyatta.
Inadequate shelter and unsustainable human settlements remain a key challenge. And I therefore continue to urge member countries and partners to seize the opportunity during this UN Habitat Assembly to exchange ideas and best practices with a view of identifying practical solutions for improving our cities and human settlements.
At the end of the 5-day summit, delegates plan to come up with a ministerial declaration with proposals on how to make cities more inclusive, safe, resilient and sustainable by 2030. Maimuna Sharif is the director of UN Habitat.
It means that we collectively need to get our growth process and our urban growth process and our cities right to solve or mitigate this problem.
That was Sarah Kimani reporting from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. And that is it for this Tuesday, May 28th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Samson O'Malley, along with our engineer John Ellison, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing all of you in Africa a very good day.
Hello, this is Peter Clotty, host of Nightline Africa. Please join us every Saturday and Sunday at 16 and 18 hours UTC. Nightline Africa is VOA's Africa's weekend show that provides news, features, and entertainment news about Africa and the world. Tune in. You will be glad you did. I guarantee it.
Join your host, Larry London, for Border Crossings, VOA's Worldwide Music Request Hour, every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in to hear your favorite songs and artists, win prizes and giveaways, and get the latest scoop from exclusive celebrity interviews. Send in requests to our Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram, or call 202-618-2077 to have your favorite music played for the entire world. Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal.
Thank you.